Election day is less than 2 weeks away, but lots of people have already cast their ballots. All but 13 states have some form of early voting this year, and as of earlier this week, more than 10 million people had already voted early.
My name is Zane Nordine. I'm 24 years old and I'm from Houston, Texas. I'm voting early, hoping to avoid long lines, but that did not end up happening today.
Chuck Faircloth, 65, from Macon, Georgia. My daddy fought in the Second World War, and he told me every time the ballot's open, I needed to be here.
Kathy Taylor, 55, Macon, Georgia. I wanted my vote to count.
In Harris County, Texas, which includes Houston, more than 180,000 voters have already cast their ballots as of early this week. That's a voting rate on par with presidential year elections. The big race, Senator Ted Cruz, is facing off against Democrat Beto O'Rourke. So why vote early?
Pamela Giroux, 75. Because my husband insists. I'd much prefer to go the normal day and see all my friends. Is that honest enough for you?
Kristen Williams, and my age is 46.
Carolyn Bosma, 59. We always do it together.
Oh, yeah.
Especially for the LGBT community, the Trump administration has been rolling back a lot of protections, civil rights, certainly using us as red meat.
Riley Miller, 36. Just to get a head start on the race. I voted the straight Republican Party ticket.
Karina, I'm 24 and I'm from Houston.
Isabel Botello, I'm 49. Just to kind of beat some of the madness.
Make sure you get it done before you start procrastinating.
Beat the crowds.
This year's election's important because I think there's a lot of flux going on in the parties and what they stand for and what individuals stand for in those parties. And I think that the votes, at some level, will send some signals.
Stephen King, I'm 66. We voted early for 20 years at this spot. I've never seen it like this. Never.
And this enthusiasm can be felt over in Georgia, too. In the first week of in-person early voting, over 480,000 votes were cast in the state, three times as many as cast at this point in 2014. Some locations have had three-hour lines, but that didn't deter voters in Macon, an hour and a half south of Atlanta. There, the state's governor's race between Democrat Stacey Abrams and Republican Brian Kemp is on many voters' minds.
Lisa Dinkins, I am 51 years old, and I am from Macon, Georgia. I'm making sure I can vote, because I may get hectic the day of, so it's best to go on out and get it now just in case something happened the day of.
My name is Vernon Rux. I decided to come early in case there is a discrepancy. I would have time to resolve it.
Philip Floyd. Don't need no Democrats in here.
If it had an R in front of it, I voted for it.
Very important to vote for Stacey Abrams.
Rosa Shaheen. I'm 92 years old, and I was born and reared in Macon. Well, I think it's every citizen's responsibility, yeah, to vote and get somebody they think that'll help the people.
This is Politics with Amy Walter from The Takeaway, and today we'll be examining all things early voting. We start with what we actually know about the numbers and what it means for the outcome of the midterms.
The early vote is telling us that we're going to have a high turnout election. We're seeing record numbers of early votes for a midterm, and in some cases in any election, including a presidential election, in many states across the country.
That's Michael McDonald, a professor at the University of Florida and founder of the U.S. Elections Project. He joined us via Skype. I spoke with him and Sasha Eisenberg, author of The Victory Lab, about the numbers.
In some states, over two-thirds of the votes will be cast prior to Election Day, and so if this early vote continues at this pace, we should see a very high turnout midterm election, maybe the highest in anyone's memory.
Are there a couple of states that you're looking at more closely than others in terms of how many people vote early and then what this early vote portends?
Well, of course, we're tracking the states that have the competitive races, and not all of them have high volume of early votes. So there's limited data in some states, but there's a lot of data in some other states. So we do get a lot of data out of Georgia, out of Florida, out of Nevada, for example, and all of those have interesting races. And then there's lots of other things going on across the country, but we get a lot of really solid, good data out of those three states. And we can see from those data right now that early voting is running at, in some cases, a record pace for a midterm election. And, you know, again, we'll just need to sit tight, see where we are by the end of next week, and that may help us understand who may win the election. You know, there's one other thing that's related here, though, to the record pace that we're seeing in these states is that pollsters make certain assumptions about who they think is going to be a likely voter. And not all pollsters use the same methodology to determine who they think is going to be a likely voter. Some of these pollsters are thinking that perhaps the electorate's going to look like a typical midterm election where we get maybe 40% of those eligible to vote. I don't think that's going to happen here. I think we're going to have a turnout rate that's higher than that. We could be at least the mid 40% range. So if we beat the 48% turnout that we had in 1966, we're going to have a turnout rate that will be the highest that we've seen in the last century. And so if pollsters aren't taking that into account when they're making up their likely voter models and weighting their polls to what they think is the profile of the voters that are going to show up for the election, then they're going to miss and they'll probably underestimate in some meaningful ways the contours of the electorate. And that could also throw off their polling numbers. So I would have more trust right now in models that have a higher turnout rather than those that think, say, the electorate's going to look like it did in 2014.
Sasha, what about you? What do you know and what has all your research shown you about the early vote and what it does or doesn't tell us about the upcoming election and the kinds of people who are showing up?
So I think what's important to realize is that while we get a lot of data from states and counties, campaigns have a lot more data about voters and often on a daily basis are getting lists back from election authorities about which individuals have voted. And so, you know, if you're a campaign and you've identified 200,000 voters in your district or state, or your get out the vote targets, every day you're getting a list of who actually voted. Did Amy vote yesterday or not? And so it opens up all these tactical questions. And one of the things that I think should give us a fair bit of uncertainty about trying to decode from early vote tallies some idea of the contours of the race is that different campaigns and parties have different strategies and tactics about how to approach early vote. And so some campaigns are making concerted efforts to mobilize certain types of voters over this period. And because this is still sort of in its infancy, it's difficult to, I think, come up with a clear idea that certain types of voters are voting early instead of just voting on election day, as opposed to being mobilized for early vote who wouldn't otherwise be voting in an election.
Yeah, that's my question. And to both of you, but Sasha, I can start with you about this idea that really, you don't want to read too much into the early vote because the theory is these are voters who would have shown up anyway. You can have huge turnout in the early vote, but it doesn't mean that you're going to see an equally large turnout on election day.
Right. I mean, so everything we're talking about, I think, is happening at the margins. And, you know, a lot of elections are decided at the margins. So the margins are important. I think two things to keep in mind as you talk about early voter or what some people call convenience voting, which refers to any situation where voters are not required to cast a ballot in person at their neighborhood voting location. So if you take all that stuff together, I think there are two big rules to keep in mind what we've learned from about a generation of this expanding. One, there have been lots of studies, and a lot of the promises when states turn to early vote is more people will vote. I think in aggregate, it is hard to see that giving people opportunities to vote in different ways and at different times in different places has not dramatically increased the pool of people who are participating. And then the second thing is that we see an increase in early vote year to year in states to the extent that they keep their rules consistent. And so there's, you know, often if you're comparing 2018 to 2014 or 2010, states have changed their rules during that time. So there's not always a clear sort of linear comparison. But more importantly, more people are participating in this. And the bulk of those overwhelmingly are people who are shifting their voting from election day to earlier. And so, yeah, we shouldn't see gains in early vote as a sort of net increase in participation. A lot of that is shifting.
Michael, what about you? What do you think about that?
Well, I think I disagree with just about everything that was said just then, because what this is analysis is missing is that we are seeing historic numbers of early votes so far in some places that are surpassing a presidential election. So we can see lots of energy out there at this moment. There are states out there that will have more than two-thirds of their votes are being cast early. And we should get a very good sense of whether or not we're going to have high turnout in those elections, that it won't just be cannibalizing of people moving around. If we see turnout numbers that are exceeding 2014, in just the early vote, that the number of early voters have already passed the total vote in 2014, I think that will be a fairly clear signal that we are going to have a higher turnout election. And there are some states that we will get a signal like that, most likely. Places like Nevada and Colorado and Oregon and Washington, they all have extremely high levels of early voting. So we can get a fairly strong signal out of those states. In other states like Tennessee today, will surpass its 2014 early vote. And we still have a week and a half of early voting to go. Over 600,000 people have voted in Tennessee so far. You know, we could be looking at 1.2 million people who have voted early in Tennessee. It's probably not just a shuffling around of when people are voting. It's also has something to do with greater enthusiasm. And there's a lot of good signals to suggest that we're going to have higher turnout. The special elections, we could look at the primary elections. Both of them had very high turnout. We've got the polls where people are self-reporting high interest in voting. And now we're getting these early vote numbers. And we even look further down and dig down in some of the data in the states that are available, where the data are available to us. We can look at past vote history. And we can see that, yes, there are people who didn't participate in 2014 who are participating in this election. So there's a lot of strong signals pointing to the fact that we're going to have higher turnout in this election, that this isn't what we're witnessing right now, which again are just historic numbers, isn't just a consequence of people shuffling around when they're going to vote. It really is a signal that people are engaged and enthused right now in this election.
Right. Now, 2014 did have very low turnout. To me, what I'm looking for personally is not just that it exceeds 2014, but we're getting somewhere to a level, no one's expecting it to hit the level of a presidential turnout, but getting and flirting close with that level. Is that what you're seeing?
Yeah, right now, again, in some states, we're actually above the 2016 election. Minnesota is one of these states. And they've been reporting their numbers for weeks now, and they've continued to be above 2016. So again, we'll just have to wait and see how this all plays out. I agree that at least some caution's warranted in whether or not this will level out. But I think the best way to think about this is that we're looking probably at a turnout rate that's going to be above 1966. And it could go much higher. It could go above 50%. And if it goes above 50%, then what we're really looking at is a turnout rate. You'd have to go all the way back to 1914 to see a turnout rate that was above 50% of those eligible. So this electorate is looking more like a presidential than a midterm, although I don't think we'll be at a presidential level. But it looks more like a presidential than a typical midterm election that we've had over the last three decades.
Sasha, I remember, I'm old enough to remember, maybe you do too, reading a lot in 2016, especially via Twitter, of campaign folks in Florida, especially those affiliated with the Clinton campaign, who said, oh my gosh, our early vote is so good, and it's a pretty good sign that Hillary Clinton's going to win Florida. And of course, it didn't exactly work out that way. So again, as we're going into these next couple of weeks here, trying to analyze the numbers that are coming out, what do we have to be careful to look for so that we don't end up in the same place as we did in 2016, which was getting data that was then ultimately not really indicative of the final vote?
So, you know, a lot of the public-facing data, we'll see the party registration of people who have already cast ballots, the race or ethnicity in some states. We should not assume that those are monolithic groups. Not everybody who's registered as a Democrat in Florida or has a history of voting in a Democratic primary in a state is going to cast the ballot for Hillary Clinton over Donald Trump or for a given Democratic Senate candidate over a given Republican candidate. So just looking at, you know, who's winning in terms of have more registered Democrats or registered Republicans cast ballots has all the problems that you could infer. The other thing worth keeping in mind, especially with 2016, is how late movement in an election intersects with early vote. So, you know, the second Comey letter came out right around this time 2 years ago. And so, you know, as we look at news events, you know, I don't know, the caravan, I guess, and the Republican messaging on that, or the president claiming he's going to issue a new tax cut, things that we think might have some persuasive power over voters, we should remember that a significant number of votes have been cast before those events take place. And I think that that's something that 2016 should be instructive on and give us a bit of caution.
And Michael, is there a difference between people who show up to vote early? You have states that allow you to come and vote at a certain location before Election Day versus those states where you can vote via the mail, you get an absentee ballot sent to you.
Right. So let me first respond to the question that you just posed, which is the election forecasting question. And the weekend before the election in 2016, I did an analysis of the early vote in the states where we were getting high early vote numbers. And you know, by and large, I correctly predicted what was going to happen in the 2016 election. Nevada and Colorado, where we get very high levels of early voting, correctly predicted those states. And then I correctly predicted how Trump would have to win the election, which was he would have to win one of these low early voting states like Pennsylvania, Michigan, or Wisconsin. He ended up winning all three of them. But again, I think there's some value in the signals that we're getting from the early voting data. And that really plays into the question that you asked me, which is that, yes, there are actually differences in the way in which people participate. Republicans tend to vote by mail. That's not a universal truth. The Democrats tend to vote in person early. And there's this this pattern that you see in the early vote as you get closer to Election Day. That's why I'm saying right now, I'm not drawing any inferences about what's happening here. I think by the end of next week, once we get the in-person early vote in a number of states, we'll be able to tell what's happened.
Sasha, what about early vote and the impact on some underrepresented groups, thinking about voters of color or younger people or people who maybe aren't frequent voters? Is there any evidence or anything that you're seeing in terms of campaign strategy that is aimed at using the early vote to get those voters engaged in the election?
Definitely Democratic campaigns that are focusing their mobilization strategies see early voting as far more friendly to the sort of lifestyles and calendars, and you know, are developing, refining get-out-the-vote tactics. There's been this sort of culture of plan making, which is a tool that comes out of the behavioral sciences, get people to visualize how they're going to get to the polls, what time they're going to go, how they're going to get there. Some campaigns calling people back or sending them a reminder of the plans that they had made. As more sort of paths open up for people to vote, the thinking is that it's more conducive to the lifestyles of people who may have multiple jobs or are going to school at odd hours, you know. And I think that there are a lot of opportunities with very targeted digital advertising to take advantage of the sort of longer window and the knowledge in some cases about who's voted and who hasn't to run really tailored campaigns at the voters who are still outstanding.
And Michael, if you can, you know, kind of think into the future down the road, maybe 10 years or more, is this what we're going to be doing, that Election Day itself is just one day on the calendar and that majority of people voting in this country are going to vote before the election even happens?
Yeah, and that's the way we used to vote a long, long time ago, back before 1845, when we set the uniform day for voting. Elections were held over multiple days, and that was to allow people the opportunity to travel from rural areas into a county courthouse to vote. And so this is nothing new. We've had it for a long time in our history of our country, and then we stopped having it for a while, then we started having it again. And starting in the 1970s, states started liberalizing their early voting laws to permit first no-excuse absentee voting, and then we saw permanent absentee voting, and so many voters were voting by mail in states like Oregon and Washington that the election officials there just sort of threw up their hands and said, why are we having these polling locations open? They're very expensive. Let's just move to all-mail ballot elections. And so that trend started out in the West. And now we've got three states who hold all-mail ballot elections. We've got California coming online with an option for their localities to do this. There's some test runs this time around, but by 2020, we should see many more counties in California that are all-mail ballot jurisdictions. places like New Jersey and Florida, you know, two states that I would say that we're going to see more and more mail balloting. And that's going to, again, feed eventually, I think, into perhaps all mail ballot elections. You can go to a vote center, like a sort of like a super polling location, and vote in person if you wish to do so. So it's not quite just all mail ballot elections. The other innovation that's happening is in West Virginia, that where military voters are allowed to vote by an app. And so we'll monitor and see how that works this time around. But that's, most of our voting innovations have come through the military first. So it's something else to be looking for in, you know, the next 10, 20 years. Do other states start adopting an app for military voters? And then do they start offering that option to domestic civilian voters as well?
Michael, Sasha, thanks so much for joining me.
Thanks, Amy.
All right, thank you.
Michael McDonald is a professor at the University of Florida and founder of the U.S. Elections Project. And Sasha Eisenberg is author of The Victory Lab. As is so often in politics, money is central to voter turnout. And this year, Democrats are fired up.
This money is coming from small dollar donors who are really, really angry about this president and are energized to participate in the midterms.
That's Elena Schneider, campaign reporter for Politico. Elena has been following the money this election season, where it's come from, who's giving it. We begin with the Democrats.
It's not always from within a candidate's district or even within the state. I think that there's been a recognition amongst Democratic activists and people who care about Democratic causes and are angry at the president, that even if they don't live in a district that is particularly competitive, that they can easily give to all kinds of candidates across the country who are. So that's primarily where a lot of this money is coming from. Obviously, they're still mega donors, but that's a good chunk of the candidate fundraising is from them.
How unusual is it that you have this many challenger candidates outraising their incumbent opponent?
There's no historical precedent for this. We have never seen this before. You're exactly right. Normally, incumbents have an edge. They have a built-in fundraising network. They're sitting on committees where PACs or companies or people who want to be familiar with said congressmen are often giving to them. And it's not as if Republicans are not raising money. They are raising money. In fact, some battleground incumbents raised even record highs. But it's just simply that the surge of money on the Democratic side is so big, is so pervasive, it's so broad and so deep that that's what these Republican incumbents are up against.
Do you have any idea how much money is being spent and how it's actually being used to try and turn out voters?
A lot of that is going towards ground game. The DCCC is investing $30 million in focusing on getting out low propensity voters, Latino voters, young voters. That's a huge chunk of money that they're focusing on sort of digital, on staffers on the ground. And in the same way, campaigns will acknowledge, look, you know, normally when you're doing budgeting for a campaign, you have to make cuts. You can't do everything because it's just so expensive. This time around for Democratic campaigns, they've been able to get it all. They've been able to spend huge amounts on television. They've been able to run a robust digital campaign. And they've also been able to bring in a lot of staffers to focus on a ground game. So I think they've sort of taken an all-above strategy because they're able to this time around. They have the money to do it.
Are they showing you any proof that this on-the-ground strategy is actually resulting either in more voters that are engaged that wouldn't have been in 2016?
Well, I think that's a very district-by-district specific question. I think that some are also more comfortable in sort of sharing and giving us a look into what's going on than others. I think there's also sort of this fear about sort of showing too much of the playbook, particularly in sort of the final stretch here. But yeah, I think that there is absolutely a focus and sort of being able to cheer on what they've been able to do in terms of increasing turnout. Democrats will point to the Virginia off-year elections back in 2017 when we just saw huge surges across the board in terms of turnout. And in individual districts, take California's 39th district, Gilsis Narrows. He was able to to eke out a victory there in a very competitive Democratic primary with tons of money getting spent, and in part because he was able to double Latino turnout over their 2014 primary turnout results. But that takes a lot of money and a lot of resources. And we're not expecting to see 2016-level turnout this year. It's still a midterm year. It's still a year that people who, you know, don't pay attention to politics are probably not going to vote. And it's not as sort of pervasive as, you know, people who are sort of glued to cable news. Those are the people who are already going to vote and are definitely going to be there. But it's still a lot of work for these campaigns to get people who are not watching cable news and who are just trying to get through their day. Those are the people that they need to get. And we're still not seeing that we're going to suddenly see presidential level turnout this year.
Up next, a look at Republican spending with Elena Schneider. Stay with us.
Today's podcast is sponsored by Babbel. People around the world are learning new languages with the Babbel Language Learning app. Learn Spanish, French, Italian, German, Russian, Swedish, and more with Babbel's 10 to 15 minute lessons. You'll learn through interactive dialogues, speech recognition, and fun trainers and quizzes. And in a few short weeks, you can be speaking a new language with confidence. And Babbel is available as an app or online. And right now, you can try Babbel for free. Go to Babbel.com and download the app and try it for free. That's right, Babbel, B-A-B-B-L-E.com, or download the app to try it for free, Babbel.com.
During a midterm election, it's always harder to generate enthusiasm for the president's party. That's not to say Republicans aren't raising a lot of money. They're just not raising as much as Democrats. And according to Elena Schneider, there's an over-reliance on outside groups who normally spend money running ads. But this year, at least one of those groups is focused on a strong ground game.
Congressional Leadership Fund is sort of the flagship Republican outside group, and they're the ones who pledged to spend $150 million this year. They've made it a huge effort to actually start opening field offices. And they've got field offices in, I think, more than two dozen districts across the country. And this is not a traditional role for outside groups or super PACs because super PACs cannot communicate with the candidate. They are legally prevented from doing that. And so there's usually they sort of exist in just sort of, as you say, flooding the airwaves with negative attack ads on Democrats. That's sort of their traditional role. But CLF decided this year that they were going to make a huge push for field organizing.
One thing that a lot of folks were surprised by in 2016 was that there were a whole bunch of voters on the Republican side that seemed to kind of come out of nowhere. Are we hearing about a similar dynamic taking place this year, or is this just a different election and a different kind of dynamic that we're going to see?
Well, I think President Trump is certainly demonstrating that he hopes that he's able to do the same thing. He's spending time in the final weeks of the campaign. He had a rally in Montana and Arizona and Nevada. Those are all places where he feels like he's going to be able to rally that base, rally those rural voters who came out in huge numbers for him. And he's trying to make that connection for voters and saying, look, even though I'm not on the ballot, pretend like I'm on the ballot. That's an effort to really try and get out those Trump voters who might stay home in a midterm year in the same way that we saw Obama voters stay home in midterm years in 2010 and 2014. The president's trying to head that off.
I remember President Obama saying similar things to his supporters, right? You got to come out, you got to vote for me because even though I'm not on the ballot, my policies are really, it's very, very important. But it was also true that the campaigns themselves were targeting those Obama voters who tend to sit out midterm elections. Are you hearing that Republicans are doing the same thing with those Trump voters this year, which is Trump is rallying them at his rallies, but they're spending money making sure that they're targeting those voters who turned out for Trump but may not normally turn out in midterm elections?
Yeah, they are absolutely trying and focusing on those chunks of voters who are Trump-based voters to make sure that they show up again in 2018. That's certainly a focus that I hear. I even was spending some time just earlier this week down in Minnesota with Jim Hagedorn's campaign. And he certainly has made the pitch to those voters. This is a rural Minnesota district that he's trying to flip, sort of an ancestrally Democratic, but has really trended towards Trump in the last 2 years. He's trying to make that pitch to candidates, basically saying, This is a miniature national election. And I think that his campaign, without a doubt, is trying to make that connection to those voters and spending money to do so. Again, I hate to keep sort of putting it off on November 6th, but we're not going to see whether or not those efforts have paid off, whether or not they have success with that, or if we see, again, sort of a drop off like we did in 10 and 14 in the Trump coalition, whether or not they're going to decide to stay home.
Has there ever been a connection made between how much money candidates spend and how many voters actually turn out?
Well, I think we're going to get an enormous set of data come November 6th. You know, I've done reporting on a couple years ago, taking a look at self-funders. So those are the kinds of candidates who have sort of a unlimited bank account where they can spend on their own race. And that didn't always translate into success. And I think that, you know, when we looked at self-funders, those were often people who didn't necessarily have sort of a built-up base of voters. They hadn't ever held elected office before. And look, we're looking at that again. We've got two-thirds of these candidates have never run for office before. So whether or not that actually, the enormous amount of spending actually translates into voters, I don't think it's any guarantee. And I think Beto O'Rourke down in Texas, who's trying to take out Ted Cruz, might be the latest example of that. Because even though he's got more money than he could probably even spend in these final weeks, he's still running up against a math problem that isn't his budget, but is just simply who lives in Texas. And there are a lot of Republicans who live in Texas.
Elena Schneider, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Elena Schneider is campaigns reporter for Politico. So far, pollsters and pundits are looking at the large early voting numbers as one indication of the energy on the left. And on the other side, President Donald Trump has been hitting the campaign trail hard to keep his base fired up.
And these are also the reasons why it's so important for each of you, each one, to get out and vote. Get out and vote. Now, if you're going to vote Democrat, don't bother.
President Trump's not on the ballot, and so the question is, will the enthusiasm at his rallies translate to Republicans up for election this year? The president certainly hopes so. He's already held more than a dozen rallies this month, including one earlier this week in Wisconsin, a state he won by a single point in 2016.
He's a great guy. Scott's opponent is an extreme liberal named Tony Evers.
Republican Governor Scott Walker is in a tight race against Wisconsin school superintendent Tony Evers.
No good. No good. So don't wait. Vote early for Scott Walker. Tremendous guy.
And whatever the outcome of the election this fall, you can bet people will look to it as a bellwether for 2020. I spoke with Craig Gilbert, the Washington bureau chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, to see if Trump's visits will energize those 2016 voters to turn out for Scott Walker.
I've been thinking about, you know, the costs and benefits of a Trump visit. And obviously, it makes a certain amount of sense for him not to go to the suburbs of Milwaukee, not to go to Madison or Milwaukee, but to go to a place like Wausau where he did well in 2016. But even in a place like Wausau, even in a place like central Wisconsin, when you look at his polling numbers, it's kind of 50-50. And this is, again, a more conservative-leaning rural part of the state. So he's not. It's not like he's more popular than Scott Walker in these places, but I guess the thinking is that if he can mobilize a certain group of Republican conservative voters, and I've talked to some people like this on the campaign trail that are pro-Trump and they're maybe a little tepid on Walker, then maybe that's worth it.
What do you see as the reason that Trump's overall approval rating is not as high in Wisconsin as it was as we were moving into the 2016 election and right after the 2016 election?
Wisconsin is one of those states where Trump's numbers were never very good. And clearly, the difference in Wisconsin was the voters that didn't like either candidate, meaning Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, broke pretty decisively for Donald Trump at the end. So there were always a lot of Trump voters that were very conflicted and had mixed feelings. And in some cases, they just disliked Hillary Clinton more than Donald Trump. So you've seen his numbers bounce around a little bit. I think his, you know, his negatives aren't that much different than they were when he won that election. But now, obviously, it's a different context because we're talking about a midterm election where he's not on the ballot. His numbers are got a little bit better, for example, in the last big statewide poll. They're still in the 40s. They've kind of bounced around from the low 40s to the mid 40s. But by any poll, you'd have to say that, you know, Scott Walker is a little more popular than Donald Trump, or a little less unpopular than Donald Trump. So again, there's sort of that mystery of what Trump does for Walker.
A lot of what I heard after the 2016 election about Wisconsin was you had two things going on. One, a very energized Republican base, especially small town rural, that we hadn't really paid much attention to because we spend so much time thinking about Milwaukee and Madison and the area around Milwaukee. But the second was that liberal voters, voters of color, either stayed home or they cast a third party ballot. Do you think, first of all, is that a fair assessment of 2016?
Well, I think Wisconsin is one of those places where you can find examples of great Democratic turnout and soft Democratic turnout. And the classic contrast would be kind of the Madison area where everybody votes and everybody's going to vote this fall and they're going to vote. Just gets bluer and bigger all the time and it's overwhelmingly Democratic and nobody thinks that that's not going to happen. Milwaukee is a much bigger question mark because you have a bigger minority population and Milwaukee has a history of dropping off in midterm elections in terms of turnout. And that mattered, you know, definitely mattered in 2016. I mean, the big change statewide was the small towns. I mean, there's sort of two kinds of communities there. And that swing was so decisive and so much the story of the 2016 election. But you've got the Republican small towns and then you got the swingy small towns. And there were like more than 500 communities in Wisconsin that voted for Obama in 2012 and voted for Trump in 2016. So those places, there is an element there of just swinginess.
You know, one of the things, Craig, that I remember looking at right after the election was suburban Milwaukee, Waukesha County, which is traditional Republican area. But this was the kind of place where we had heard stories, I'm sure you'd written many of them, about these conflicted suburban voters, suburban women who were upset about the Access Hollywood tape. And Trump did not do as well in Waukesha as Mitt Romney did, but Hillary Clinton didn't do any better than Obama did. Do you think that's changing? Now we hear so much now about suburban women, especially in these more affluent areas. Do you expect to see that Waukesha behaves differently this year?
Well, this is a fascinating question because there's cross currents, really interesting cross currents there because, you know, the suburbs in Milwaukee are a little different than the suburbs in a lot of other cities. Its size, they're pretty Republican. They have a real and again, we're talking about in some many cases college educated voters, higher income voters. They do have this very Republican history that's unusual in a national context. And so here comes Donald Trump, and they didn't like him in the primary. They kind of underperformed for him in the general election. But at the same time, again, that's been the heart of Walker's strength in his election. So you got Walker pulling them one way, Trump pulling them another way. And I will be very interested to look at those numbers in the midterm elections because, again, Trump's not on the ballot. But again, there are people that clearly Republicans that have qualms about Trump. At the same time, there's like this partisan pull in a lot of these communities. And they're very active, politically engaged, and they have this history of just jumping into these kind of political wars with both feet. And if Republicans want to try to offset, you know, the pretty big numbers that are going to come out of Madison and Dane County, they need a pretty robust vote out of these outer Republican suburbs of Milwaukee.
So, Craig, all that being said, is there a Trump effect in this election?
Well, it's there, but it's not something that the candidates are spending all their time talking about. I mean, even the Democrats, I think they see it as something that's a given. And so they don't need to organize their TV ads around trying to tie Scott Walker to Donald Trump. And also, and by the same token, you know, Scott Walker's always had this kind of awkward relationship with Trump. They ran against each other. Trump would beat up on Walker, but Walker is very aware that Trump is popular with Republican voters. So whenever he kind of distances himself from a Trump policy, he does that very carefully. So yeah, it's there. It is the elephant in the room in a lot of ways.
Craig Gilbert, thank you for joining us.
It's a pleasure.
Craig Gilbert is the Washington Bureau Chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. We end the hour here at The Takeaway with a look at how and why not everyone has easy or equal access to voting.
For some reason in this country, we have had this ethos of rather than kind of opening up the vote and access to the vote, there have been forces in elected office that have sought to make voting harder, not easier.
Vanita Gupta is president and CEO of the Leadership Conference on Civil Rights. She worked in the Civil Rights Division at the U.S. Department of Justice during the Obama administration.
Last year, there were 99 bills that had been introduced in over 31 state legislatures to restrict access to the vote. And it takes a lot of different forms.
Those efforts, not all of which have passed, we should mention, have come in the form of enacting tougher voter ID laws, moving polling stations, and most recently,
we have seen a surge of efforts to restrict access to the polls through voter purging. That's now been made famous in the Ohio case, where the Supreme Court just recently allowed for people basically to get purged off of the voter rolls if they hadn't voted in the last two federal election cycles.
This practice is known as use it or lose it. And in Georgia, more than 100,000 people were removed from the voting rolls in 2017. At least 9 states have a similar policy. Also in Georgia, 53,000 voters have been placed on a pending list. That means their eligibility to vote is being reviewed. And this, too, disproportionately affects people of color.
And what we are doing is contacting them to make sure that they know what their rights are and what their recourse is to having their vote counted. I think the concern is that, you know, many of them will think that they need to stay out of this election, and we are trying to encourage them to show up to vote using the provisional ballot, and then we're going to have to be keeping tabs on what happens with those provisional ballots. There are a number of civil rights groups like the Lawyers Committee, the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, Campaign Legal Center, and others that will be kind of primed for pursuing litigation if and as unlawful things take place after the election. But right now we're kind of in the lead up to it, making sure that those voters know their rights and know how to be counted.
Well, Vanita, how do we determine what is an appropriate tool that the Secretary of State's office can use to make sure that the voter rolls are clean, that they don't have, you know, multiple problems with voters at different addresses, that we don't have any type of fraud going on, that dead people aren't all those things that you hear about elections? How do you decide which of those things is actually what the Secretary of State's office is supposed to be doing to protect the integrity of the election versus one that we determine is suppressive in its intent?
Yeah, look, Secretaries of States have been running elections for a long time, and long before the Supreme Court sanctioned use it or lose it mechanism that they sanctioned in Ohio's voter purging, Secretaries of State were maintaining their roles and making sure that dead people were no longer on the rolls and the like. And of course, Secretaries of State need to be able to make sure that their voter rolls are up to date. But voting in America had never been a use it or lose it right. And it is not a privilege handed to some. It is a right that is conferred on U.S. citizens. And there are measures written into the National Voter Registration Act that was enacted really primarily in the 90s to ensure greater registration opportunities for more vulnerable communities. And that's what Secretaries of State have been relying on for years through election cycle after election cycle to make sure that the voter rolls were cleaned. There have been a lot of studies, bipartisan studies, done to try to detect mass voter fraud, and not a single one has ever revealed mass voter fraud. It was part of the reason why you saw Secretaries of States from states as wide-ranging as Mississippi to California protesting when the president established this Pence-Kobach Voter Suppression Commission, as I call it, headed by the vice president and Chris Kobach, the Kansas Secretary of State, who's had a longstanding agenda to restrict voting rights. Ultimately, the commission got brought down through litigation, but there was zero evidence whatsoever to back up the president's claim that 3 to 5 million people had voted illegally in the 2016 election. And so this is what's dangerous about where we're at, which is this myth of voter fraud is perpetuating a series of policies that result in the suppression of the vote in certain communities. But I think we just have to admit that this has long been a very racialized agenda. The seeds of this have been rooted in Jim Crow and slavery, and that we are today contending with a whole slew of different mechanisms by which people have been seeking to restrict the right to vote among communities that are perceived to be heavily Democratic. And those increasingly in our polarized country are communities of color.
A number of conservatives, Republicans will say, look, there's no evidence that we are suppressing the vote. And the fact is, anybody can show up and vote. They can fill out a provisional ballot. We're not denying anyone access to the polls. This is not the 1960s. And the fact that Democrats are blaming this On voter suppression, really what they should be looking at is the reason why their message isn't resonating with voters that they want to get to the polls.
That is conflating voter turnout with the actual ability to have people who show up at the polls have their votes counted. And there has been ample evidence, and federal court after federal court after federal court has found states that have engaged in intentional racial discrimination in enacting restrictive measures to prevent people from voting as recently as just this past year. There is a long history of voter suppression in this country. It has taken a whole range of forms, from literacy tests and poll taxes and grandfather clauses to the kind of unlawful purging, overly restrictive ID requirements that we see today. We have to be really vigilant to fight back on voter suppression, but I also think that the other message has to be that people need to show up and exercise this right. It has been a right that people have died for, that was secured by the blood, sweat, and tears of advocates and activists that came before us. And I think in this election in particular, which may be the most important election in our lifetimes, everything is at stake. Fundamental American values are at stake, and it's why there is such a groundswell of activism and get out the vote efforts that people feel really, you know, engage in making sure that there's much higher turnout.
Vinita Gupta is the president and CEO of the Leadership Conference on Civil Rights. All right, one more thought from my brain this hour. I'm having some flashbacks to 2016. Back then, as now, we were watching a split-screen election. One shows crowds waiting to get into Donald Trump rallies. The other shows long lines at early polling centers filled with voters of color. And just like 2 years ago, we're trying to interpret which will tell us more about who will win on Election Day. Those lines at early voting places didn't predict victory for Hillary Clinton in key states like Florida or North Carolina. And voters who never even attended a MAGA rally did get to the polls for Donald Trump. But midterm elections are more sensitive to fluctuations in turnout. Fewer people overall vote in non-presidential years, which means even minor changes in the composition of the electorate can have massive consequences. In other words, even just a few hundred voters showing up to vote who don't normally vote can determine the outcome of a bunch of races. No one knows what will happen if, as Professor McDonald suggested, we have higher voter participation than any midterm election since 1914. But what we do know is this. The Trump era has engaged and enraged voters like none in modern times. And even as we may hit record levels of turnout in 2018, I suspect we're going to be flirting with record voter engagement for the foreseeable future. You can always find us on Facebook and leave a comment there. Also, if you missed anything or you want to listen back again, check out our podcast on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Amy Walter. This is The Takeaway.